being able to comply with the instructions in our life. And we have the obligate anaerobes, which must be without oxygen, and not so obviously, they too can cause infections in our body, areas of the body that don't have high levels or maybe no levels of oxygen. The obligate anaerobes are sometimes called strict anaerobes, and in those settings, you are able to be actually killed by oxygen. So the fact that the obligate anaerobes are strict anaerobes, we have to use oxygen as part of the therapy. The organism. And we have the facultative anaerobes, and these are organisms that can function with or without oxygen. They have a dual energy system. If oxygen is present, it uses oxygen. If oxygen is not present, it can use a fermentation process. We have multiple ways of multiple strategies for the organism to survive. And they do indeed, and they cause infection. Obviously, if you're trying to grow an organism that's a strict anaerobe in the lab, you have to grow it in the absence of oxygen. In fact, you have to collect a sample in the absence of oxygen. So that's a way of doing that. So that we don't kill the organism from the patient to the lab, that we allow the organism to grow in the absence of oxygen in the lab. But other than that, it's pretty straightforward. Oxidation reduction, we've talked about the availability of electrons in the medium, and that there's a balancing in the biosphere between the availability of electrons and the need for reducing equivalents. We have to balance out the charges, just like we did in organic chemistry. And this, although it's a simple kind of idea, is an important one. So that we mentioned last time, that if we have an anaerobic infection, for example, and the organism is growing in the wound site, it actually needs to have reducing equivalents, that is, hydrogen sources, NADH, NADPH, that's given to the organism, and it's given to the organism by the dead and dying tissue of the patient. That dead and dying tissue of the patient then needs to be removed because it's getting aid and comfort to the entry organism. And that's called debridement. Debridement could mean the flap of skin and yourself fishing or something, swimming a fish or something into the flap of skin, or it could be the removal of a limb, a foot, below the knee, or whatever it might be. Coupled with the anaerobic conditions, it could be a little bit of a patient study, and that would be classic diabetic. The diabetic has problems, as we've learned in biochemistry, they have problems with insulin and the like. But if we follow the patient history, they also have other kinds of problems which don't seem to be directly related to insulin. And what it is such things as eye problems, blindness possibly. They may have infections in their feet. And how is this related to the fact that they have problems with insulin? The answer is that when we have a blood vessel, it has to be constantly maintained. It's like room 2 across the UP, and it's constantly maintained. And so to do that, we have to have a repair process. And that repair process is interfered with by the presence of glucose. And when you have high levels of glucose in the bloodstream, block calcination occurs, that is, sticky glucose sticks to everything, and it sticks to the lining of the blood vessel. It also sticks to the red blood cell, and we have a lab test for that. But in addition, it's sticking to the lining of the blood vessels, and that sticky glucose prevents the repair. Sort of like the snow in the summertime, in the fall, in the winter, in the spring, in the UP. When there's snow on the ground, you can't repair the road. When there's glucose covering all of the lining of the blood vessel, like oscillation, then the repair doesn't occur. So the normal repair necessary to maintain the blood vascular system is not occurring. And that results in impotence in the male, blindness, and also poor circulation in the extremities. And that means anaerobic conditions in the extremities. So we have low oxygen concentration getting to the tissue because we don't have a repair system. This is a chronic, ever-growing problem for the diabetic. Without blood supply to the tissue, we have anaerobic conditions. So all we need to do is introduce the organism, and we are off and running relative to having an anaerobic infection. Now, to complicate matters even further, the loss of blood supply results in peripheral neuropathy. That is, the nervous system is not functioning as it should. And so the patient that has a moderate infection, the whole foot isn't involved yet, but it's something serious they should know about, but they don't know about it, or if they do know about it, they don't think it's too serious because it doesn't hurt too much. Pain being an indicator of severity of the patient. But in this setting, pain is not going to be there in the degree that would warrant the patient's attention. And so we have a peripheral neuropathy developed in what I call the diabetic stomp. You can hear them walking because they have a heavy foot. The reason why they have a heavier than normal foot strike is because they can't feel the foot strike on a normal level. So they have to have a bigger downward force. It's a gradual process, they're not aware of it. And maybe they're halfway up the calf before they actually feel the foot strike. So they have to reverberate hard enough that they can feel it halfway up the calf. All these are signs of peripheral neuropathy, which are also signs of poor blood flow to the tissue. Hair falls off the toes and all that kind of stuff. All these things happen. The skin starts changing color and texture and thickness, and all this is due to peripheral damage to the blood vessel. So they are now primed. They are anaerobic conditions, and all we have to do is add the organism. And a slight blister, a little cut, all it takes. And then we have the anaerobic organism growing. And now we have to do the amputations, or we have to do the extensive debridement. Not only where the organism is growing, but in the area around the organism that's providing aid and comfort to the organism. That is supply, reducing the problem. So this little chart in the previous discussion about oxygen is really the root behind serious consequences of diabetes. And of course, we have that NADH, for example, of a compound used to carry hydrogen. The uptake of nutrients, I think it's get into the cell. Well, it's a coordinated event. Coordinated event. Exoenzymes, or enzymes secreted by the organism, they're released into the media. They're stored in the area between the cell wall and the cell membrane, known as a periplasmic space. And they basically digest the media. Examples would be substrates, would be polysaccharides, and there are many different kinds of polysaccharides you can see. Cellulose, starch, and so on. Mucopolysaccharides, such as chitin. What is chitin? Chitin is the material of the exoskeleton of an insect. So you walk on a bug with an exoskeleton, and it goes pop on the sidewalk. Chitin is also the main structure of the cell wall of the fungal organism. We'll remind you that in the review today. So the fungal organism has basically a homopolymer of glucosamine. So we talked about the cell wall of gram-positive with M's and G's and M's and G's. Well, the basic structure of the cell wall of the fungal organism is just G, 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 G. It's a homopolymer of glucosamine. That's what chitin is. So it's something for the first exam material as well as now. That's something we'll talk about in the review relative to the structure of the cell wall of fungal organism. Hyaluronic acid. Anyone remember what hyaluronic acid is? We had it in physiology. We might even have it in general biology. The brain chemistry is working quite well. Chitin. Remember you talked about cells and how cells form tissues? And they talked about the cell cement. Right? Hyaluronic acid is exactly that. Hyaluronic acid is the stuff that holds cells together to form tissues. So if an organism produces the enzyme, and that break down tissues. So the organism has this enzyme in its repertoire of exoenzymes, and it's growing in your leg. It can easily cause the cells of your leg, the tissue to separate, allow the organism to spread easily. Lecithin. A bit of lecithin. Lecithin is a phospholipid. Phospholipid is found in your membrane. Okay. So the organism has lecithin, the very form of lecithin. So proteases, trypsin, chymotrypsin, whatever it is. RNA and DNA bases to break down RNA and DNA. And you can see the whole variety of things. Again, this is sort of general biology kind of thing. Various kinds of compounds, break down carbohydrates and sugars and lipids and proteins and all that. So basically, these exoenzymes are taking the patient to lunch, and the patient is lunch. So that's a virulence factor. We take offense of being digested by the organism. So this is a significant situation. But for the organism, it's just a way of doing business. It's breaking down its environment, which happens to be the patient. And as it breaks down the environment, it breaks it down into units that are identical with the needs of their transport mechanism. So it breaks down the environment to match the transport system. That's a specific transport system that brings in specific amino acids or specific sugars or whatever. So the carbohydrates broken down into the units that will be matching the transport system. And then the transport system brings it in ready to be used for its metabolism. It's a coordinated event. But this is also something that occurs in nature apart from us being digested. We take everything personal. We don't need to. The organism isn't personally trying to get John Brown. It's just simply going for breakfast. So environmental factors are that. And not only the patient is an environment, but the biosphere is an environment. So when we say something is biodegradable, we say that there's really what we're saying is that there's an enzyme produced by a microorganism, a bacteria or a yeast fungal organism. There's an enzyme produced by that organism that breaks it down. Obviously it breaks it down for its use, but it's breaking it down nonetheless. Now as a society, we have a bit of a problem with this. As a society, we're sort of like, a little later in the course, we'll talk about STDs behavioral kinds of situations and frontal lobe development, or so-called, referring to the connection of cause and effect, of actions and consequences. And so the late teens and early 20s, those are separated. So you don't know the immediate effect of the consequence. And so it was four sons. So sons do sons things, and when they're in that roughly that age, they get a motorcycle that is, you know, 950 or 1100 or something like this, and they can go 150 miles an hour down Route 31. Rite of passage if they make it. If they have to run into a turtle or a small rock, then they're dead. You start a wall with 150 miles an hour, you're not going to survive. Okay? But you wouldn't think about that when you're 19. When you're 27, you say, that was a stupid thing. Well, our world is that way now. We are in that era, it seems, that we don't necessarily connect consequences and actions and what we do and connect it with some sort of thing that's going to happen later. What's happening is, in post-World War II, I know that's not your particular era, but post-World War II, which is where your parents came from, most likely, then, and your grandparents for sure, what happened was that we had an explosion of chemistry. Better living through chemistry was DuPont's ad. And so now we've created a whole bunch of new compounds. One might call them unnatural compounds. Biosynthesized compounds that we do in the lab, creating multiple changes in what nature would do. And then there's those that are totally artificial. So we need to take compounds that don't fit in with enzyme systems produced by microorganisms. So if you tour Europe, and you see the castles and so on. You see stone buildings, but you don't see the wooden doors and the leather hinges and that sort of stuff. All you see is a stone. That's what survived, but we know that God had another grave for stone and wearing away the rubble. However, currently, your life is full. Again, not your fault, it's something you grew up with, but it's something the consequences are becoming more and more apparent. Your life is full of things that don't go away. Okay. You probably have had contact in the last 48 hours with a milk jug. Maybe the half-gallon size, maybe the quart size, right? The estimates are, since that's made out of a plastic, a polymer that is not biodegradable, estimates are that it will last, under the right conditions, as short as 800 years. At that point, we end up with plastic dust. So it won't be like going to Europe and seeing only the little bits of stone left. But every toy you ever had, every plastic toy you ever had, is still here. It hasn't gone anywhere, it's just out of sight. We bury it in the ground. Canadians send their garbage down here, and we bury it this here as well. With Canadian garbage in the city, we have our garbage. And we just bury it on the ground as if it disappeared. It's sort of like peekaboo with a, you know, a 1-year-old with an 18-month-old kid. Peekaboo's gone. Close your eyes. It's a Piaget development thing. If you can't see it, it's gone. No, it's not gone. It's still here. Okay? So all those very funny things that we make, various things that we make out of petroleum, plastics, plastic bags. We go to a grocery store and we get a plastic bag, and inside we have a plastic packaging material that has a plastic toy inside, and it lasts for 15 minutes or maybe 2 days, maybe really long time, like 2 weeks, and then it's broken and it's put into the bag and thrown in the garbage, and it disappears. But it hasn't disappeared. Every piece of plastic you have ever seen or touched, every toy, every glass, every milk container is still here. As if you would sort of have it on a bag behind your leg and you just carry it around. So think about when you discard something. It isn't gone. It's still here. All your past sins are to be reckoned with. So what happens then is that we need to come back and balance. And how do we do that? Well, we either make packaging material and toys and bags and so on out of material that we can break down with existing enzymes, or we find a new enzyme that's being used for some other purpose, maybe in the disappearing Amazon forest place or something. And we find this new enzyme from an unusual organism, and it breaks it down. Then we go to these old mines of garbage dumps, and we can convert them back to raw materials. So right now, there's probably in third grade someone who ultimately will become a biotech engineer, and they will become a multi-billionaire because they're going to buy up all these landfills that have no value except for the fact that they're full of old, used but not gone petrochemicals, and they'll just simply the organisms in and harvest out all the different carbohydrates they need, the melody, the carbon bonds they need, and they'll remanufacture them in some sort of matrix goo of some sort, which then can be used for other things. And they're actually reusing it. And they're going to sell it back to the consumers that threw it away in the first place. Okay. But until we complete that loop, we are driving along at 155 miles an hour down 131. It just takes eminent common sense to the microbial world that there's a balance, that you cycle things. Once that freshman world, it looks a little complex on top of the idea of where all the leaves go. His idea is a little tricky. They all blow through Ohio. The wind blows them away. That's where they go. They just get blown away. No thought about the microorganisms actually breaking down in your own backyard. So there will be a whole host of technologies that need to be developed, including some microorganisms that need to be re-engineered to break down what we throw away. Okay, so to be aware of the fact that we are currently part of the problem as a society, but ultimately we'll be centers of these extra enzymes, capable of digesting almost anything that is natural. Well, how do things get inside? Well, it could get inside by simple diffusion. Simple diffusion is that. It is movement with the concentration gradient. That's that means there, concentration gradient. That means it moves from high concentration to low concentration. So we break a bottle of perfume in the front of the room, and eventually you just smell it in the back row. From high concentration to low concentration. Now, simple diffusion doesn't require any energy, that's good news, but it also is not controllable. If the organism finds itself in a high concentration of something that it really wants, it will suck up all of that and then explode with osmotic lysine. So it's a danger. We need to take a situation. There's no energy required, no carrier. It just comes in all by itself. This is very dangerous. It's not controllable. So we have to have a carrier-mediated system. Carrier allows us to control the process. It provides for specificity. So a carrier will pick up only certain kinds of compounds. And it has a saturation effect, meaning there's only so many carrier molecules available in the membrane itself. And when they're all busy, then you can't take any more in. Okay. So there's a maximum rate in which you can bring things in the cell, and all the carriers are full, and then things level off. We can take a look at this, and then we see roughly a sigmoidal shaped curve, an S-shaped curve here. And this might be the lead in the S, but something like that. And then flattened out. It's sort of asymptotes, laying out this one. Asymptotes out, the different white pieces are in maximum. And basically what's happening is that this is leveling off. Whereas simple diffusion is not very great, so it's less brought in. But there's no endpoint. It just continues to decline. So as you increase the concentration on the outside, you can increase the amount brought in to simple diffusion. Whereas with carrier mediated, at a certain point when you increase it, it does no longer increase the amount brought in. The carrier is saturated. Now, facilitated diffusion is one of those carrier mechanisms. And again, we've heard this in general biology, I'm sure. No energy required. Substrate remains unchanged. It's moving with the concentration gradient. And we have some amino acids and some sugars brought in this way. And this is certainly an easy, inexpensive, meaning no ATP required, an easy, inexpensive mechanism by which we can bring something into the cell, facilitate the diffusion, and yet still have control over it because we can max the amount to bring in and find ourselves in a very high concentration of the outside. Carrier will become saturated. But it's moving with the concentration gradient. So it's showing the compound costing ATP gradient. And we have active transport. Active transport, probably again remember the energy required. Substrate is brought in unchanged. Movement with, excuse me, movement against the concentration. We can actually have an increased amount inside the cell, a smaller amount on the outside of the cell. Many amino acids and some sugars are brought in this way. So because it's moving against the concentration gradient, we find ourselves in a very low concentration of that, we can suck it up. Now, that because we're going against the concentration gradient, low concentration outside, higher concentration inside, it's going to require energy. Remember earlier, the previous one, we have a situation where we have high concentration on the outside, and we're bringing it in, it's easy, it's downhill, so to speak. It doesn't cost us anything. But this costs us ATP. The cell is very careful about things that cost ATP. It avoids it as much as possible. Okay, there's an alternate way of getting something done without ATP, the cell is going to want to offer that. Guards the concentration of ATP carefully. It also guards the concentration of reducing equivalents carefully. Group translocation, this is one you didn't have in general biology. Group translocation. The group that's being translocated in this particular example is phosphate. phosphotranspirase system. Energy is required. We do phosphorylate the substrate, so we've altered it. And movement against concentration gradient. And this is how we bring in glucose and fructose. Now it begins inside the cytoplasm. And hydrogen phosphate compound called phosphoenolpyruvate, you've heard of this, PEP. So there's an enzyme one of the two enzymes in this process. The first enzyme occurring on the inside of the cytoplasm takes PEP, converts it to pyruvate, and takes the hydrogen phosphate bond from PEP and puts it onto a carrier. So now we have a phosphorylated carrier. So step one, enzyme one, we take a carrier molecule inside of the membrane and we phosphorylate it. This phosphorylated carrier moves to the outside of the cell. And a second enzyme, specific for the given sugar, so there's an enzyme, Roman numeral 2, an enzyme 2 for glucose, and an enzyme 2, different one, for fructose, and so on. Enzyme 2 will bind, in this case glucose, to the phosphorylated carrier. So now we have a carrier. Got an hydrogen phosphate bond attached to it, and now the carrier on the outside of the membrane has glucose. This moves then through the membrane. In the process, you create an unstable resonance structure. You have that in organic chemistry, resonance structure. So we have, as part of this, we have three parts. We have a carrier, we have a phosphorylated carrier, and we have a glycosylated carrier. And now we form a bond between the glucose and the hydrogen phosphate bond. So we have carrier, hydrogen phosphate bond, glucose, carrier. We have a three-part structure. And the electrons are wanting where they're supposed to be, so they're moving around, resonance structure. As this moves through to the surface of the inside surface of the membrane, glucose wins and seals the hydrogen phosphate bond and becomes glucose 6 phosphate. Sounds familiar? Starting the glycolysis? Do that. So now we pull this phosphorylated glucose off. That leaves our carrier all alone again. And this is the hydrogen phosphate bond. Enzyme 1 takes the hydrogen phosphate bond from PEP, results in a phosphorylated carrier that then floats to the surface of the membrane, picks up glucose again, returns back to the resonance structure, bumps off glucose 6 phosphate, and begins the whole process again and again and again. Okay. So the phosphotransferase, we're moving phosphate around. We take it from PEP, we add it to a carrier, then we add it to glucose. So notice that we take a polymer of glucose, glycogen or something, and we break it down with the exoenzyme so that it can be picked up, and in the process of bringing it through the membrane, we phosphorylate it so it's all ready to go for glycolysis. It's an integrated system. So we're already preparing this for glycolysis by the process of bringing it in. So there are two enzymes, enzyme 1 on the inside, enzyme 2 on the outside, a specific enzyme 2 for each sugar. Group translocation. The group that's being translocated is the hydrogen phosphate compound. It went from PEP to the carrier to glucose. A little bit about the reaction series. Not too much detail. Again, we were doing the lectures in med text and biotech, we'll go into a bit more detail. But we have some understanding of the outcome. Basically, we can transform energy, you know, the physics class and so on. In high school, you probably have to do that. And thermodynamics have figured out that energy can't be created or destroyed, so we just move it around. And we can move it around by fermentation, by respiration, and by photosynthesis. Photosynthesis, we have electrons from wavelengths, absorb other chloroplasts. It ultimately ends up in the carbon-carbon bonds of glucose photosynthesis only occurs in blue-green algae, as well as typically prokaryotes, and blue-green algae don't cause the disease. So, no consequence to us in this focus of this course. But fermentation and respiration, that could be important. Let's talk about those two. In respiration, we can define this as an inorganic compound with a final electron acceptor. So, can we define rather specifically inorganic compound as a final electron acceptor? So, we're going to have a flow of electrons. Inorganic compound is going to be the last one to pick up that flow of electrons. Fermentation, we have a flow of electrons. And the final electron acceptor is an organic compound. So that's a very specific focus. We're going to take glucose as our source of both, remember we broke down the organism's metabolism, so source of energy, electrons, and the source of carbon. So we have glucose. Carbon's there, and we break it down. Glycolysis, you had that in biochemistry class. So we can break that down to pyruvate, and then pyruvate can be further disassembled, and these carbons are going to end up in the Krebs cycle, and the electrons are hopefully going to end up in ATP. So we have the electrons that are in the bonds, and our intermediate is pyruvate. Now, somehow students get focused so heavily on glycolysis that they forget what it means to be an intermediate. And so the end product of glycolysis, the end product of the breakdown of glucose, is not pyruvate, that's an intermediate, but the end product is going to be ATP production. The end product is going to be those carbon-carbon bonds that are usually amino acids that are being recycled in the Krebs cycle. So bugs haven't forgot that, but sometimes biochemistry students do, they sort of get focused on pyruvate. That's just an intermediate. So we take six carbons down to three. And there are several ways of doing that. The classic way is the Epimara-Parnas pathway, sometimes called the EM or Epimara pathway. But I figure if you name that to people, you might put down all families, so your Parnas family gets the appropriate recognition. So the Epimara-Parnas pathway. The EMP pathway is the classic way. Then we have a backup system called the pentose phosphate, or the hexose monophosphate shunt. Again, you've heard about that. Sure. So the hexose monophosphate shunt is when we take a 6-carbon compound, pull off the carbon dioxide, and we then have a 5-carbon compound, and we have a system that runs on 5-carbon compounds. Pentose, 5-carbon. Hexose. And then we have an odd one, enterodeuterol. That one you probably don't care about. And the enterodeuterol pathway is another backup system. So our main one is EMP and a couple of backups. Let's take a look at this. Again, very simple for you. Glucose to pyruvate is the Epimara. And the Epimara is a major raw breakdown of glucose to pyruvate in your cell and in bacterial cells. And this is done without oxygen. So the breakdown down to pyruvate occurs with or without the presence of oxygen. It doesn't require it, so it occurs with or without the presence of oxygen. So this can occur in the aerobes, in the strict anaerobes, in the facultative anaerobes. They all can do this, okay? Because oxygen is not required to the point of going down to that intermediate. So the EMP pathway will take glucose to pyruvate without oxygen. Now the pentose pathway, 5 carbons. So right away we have to pull off the carbon dioxide. We get a 5-carbon pathway. And that's going to regenerate, that step, it regenerates some reducing equivalents. So we can take NADP and make it NADPH. That's why we have the pathway. This produces more reducing equivalents, but it's expensive. About half the amount of ATP per mole of glucose is lost. That's not quite half, but about, because we have 6 carbons gives us 2 3s for the simple arithmetic. 5 carbon gives us 1 3 plus a 2. There's some recycling of that too, but basically that's going to be lost. We're not going to get the full amount back. So by pulling off that carbon dioxide initially, we've reduced in half, approximately, the amount of ATP production for the whole glucose. This is an expensive procedure. The cell is going to have to work twice as hard to get the same amount of ATP if it has to go to the store and buy reducing the glucose. It doesn't want to do that. We'd much rather use the EMP pathway and get a lot of ATP. But if there isn't any, if there isn't sufficient levels of reducing equivalents around, the cell will do that. The same is true with the antiglucuron. Reducing equivalents are made in this setting as well. And again, we get less ATP per mole glucose. So what clinical value is that? Remember that patient that was the patient with the anaerobic infection and they were diabetic and we had to debride the wound, which might mean amputation. When we debride the wound and remove the dead and dying tissues that are providing reducing equivalents, the remaining organisms must produce their own reducing equivalents. So now it has to use the backup system to produce less ATP. So that sort of slows its ability to cause disease, slows the rate of growth of the organism. A little harder for the organism to survive, and that's good for the patient. Anything that makes it hard for the organism to survive is good for the patient. So the debridement, the removal of dead and dying tissue, is not so the wound looks pretty. Not so that, you know, now we take a flap of skin off and air gets there and air cures you. No, it's not great. But what happens is we're forcing the organism to use a less desirable breakdown of glucose. We're forcing the organism reducing equivalents. If we give it to it already, it's going to use the EMP pathway and it's going to grow really, really well. So the basis of that treatment, of debridement, requires us to understand what's going on with the breakdown of glucose, what's going on with reducing equivalents and all that sort of stuff. That's why we do it. Now, the phase of pyruvate, three ways of getting to pyruvate. None of those mechanisms require oxygen. Now we have a different system. We have to break down the pyruvate. And we're going to see the Krebs cycle, then of course is where the carbons go. And we have there, you can see the Krebs cycle, and we're going to be making a variety of amino acids from those cycles. Again, you can see biochemistry, but I'm going to show you the supply to the triggers of the microbial world as well. And so we're going to be making amino acids. We don't throw those away. We recycle. The Krebs cycle is recycling carbon. Electron transport system is the flow of electrons. Again, final electron acceptor, final product. Final electron acceptor we mentioned already. We define respiration and fermentation. And the final product. Again, respiration interdicts the compound as a final electron acceptor and as the final product. You can have aerobic respiration. See this one before. But aerobic respiration, we're going to break down organic compounds and we're going to be producing ATP. And our final electron acceptor under aerobic respiration, meaning respiration with oxygen, aerobic, is oxygen. And wherever there's a flow of electrons in a biological system, there's going to be a need for hydrogen. That's the Canadian scientist discovered that. Anybody can tell? It's the Canadian scientist Leo Gurr. Leo Gurr, loss of electrons, oxidation, gain in electrons production. Leo Gurr. So this process of flow of electrons has nothing to do with the Canadian scientist. It's really the loss of electrons. And so we have a flow of electrons, but to have that flow of electrons, we have to have availability of hydrogen, again, coming from those reducing equivalents. Intimate relationship between ATP production and reducing equivalents. So those hydrogens are coming on, so therefore our final electron acceptor is oxygen, and that becomes O2 minus, and that's not a really stable kind of compound. So we have to add hydrogen to that, as we did all the way down the line with phosphoelectron production and gain electron oxidation. We had that same process. So our final electrons bind to the oxygen, and we have to add hydrogen. So our final product then is water. Now this occurs in your body as well. So you breathe in oxygen, binds to the hemoglobin, grows to the cells, pumps off the hemoglobin into your mitochondria. Remember, bacterial cells have a membrane, but in your cells, it's in the mitochondria. It sits to the bottom electron transport second for an instant, converted to water, and that allows for continuous flow. We have to have oxygen as our low-level compound to have the flow. It's sort of like the kinetic energy that's generated when you have water going off a cliff, a waterfall. The greater the waterfall height, the greater amount of kinetic energy change, and the greater amount of energy we can generate in mobile electricity, which is also a large amount of flow of electrons. So we need a low-level compound to have a difference between pyruvate and whatever we're going to end with. The greater that distance, the greater the amount of ATP we can get out of that flow. Because there are several locations along that distance between pyruvate and oxygen that will have sufficient levels to have a flow of electrons down there in the ventricular system, and importantly enough, a bundle of electrons equals the amount of energy in a hydrogen phosphate bond. So that allows us to regenerate ADP to ATP. This bundling of energy, right? So, we had hopefully that already, but basically this was applying the microbe. So we're making ATP, several places, three places along the way, you know, and then we have then oxygen converted to water. So again, under aerobic respiration, we have an inorganic compound as our final electron acceptor, and that aerobic respiration, that inorganic compound is oxygen. Well, organisms can use other things. And we can have anaerobic respiration. That is to say, we can have respiration without oxygen. So something other than oxygen is our inorganic compound. Now the person who typed this up, that is our cartoonist, this should say inorganic here. Minor problem for them, major problem for us. So this should say inorganic electron acceptor. So we can have a variety of these compounds. We can have sulfur. We can add sulfur to the list, for example. So if we have sulfur as our final electron acceptor, then what's our final product? H2S. Okay. And we still have the flow of electrons and so on. Everything is just dandy, except for the fact we're not using oxygen. And we have a different end product. Okay. So those Italians who got trying to describe how it was that people got this disease that they called malaria, meaning bad air disease. They didn't realize it was the mosquitoes carrying the parasite, malaria. They found the bad smell, malaria, bad air. The bad smell caused the disease. And the bad smell they smelled was H2S, swamp gas. Smells like rotten eggs. So in the muck of the swamp, the organisms are using anaerobic respiration. Sulfur is a final electron acceptor. They have a good flow of electrons because sulfur can be a low-level energy compound, so we're getting lots of ATP. And we're producing not water, but we're producing H2S. And you can see we can produce sulfuric acid and sulfur. You know, what compound we use for final electron acceptor. So in these systems, respiration, we get the maximum amount of ATP production. If we break this all the way down, there's no carbon-carbon bonds left. The electrons in the carbon-carbon bonds, we break them all down, we capture them all. Now, we do have the terms aerobic metabolism and anaerobic metabolism. That sometimes confuses people. Aerobic metabolism is only aerobic respiration. Anaerobic metabolism is a form of metabolism without the presence of oxygen, and that could be anaerobic respiration, which we just described, or it could be fermentation. So two forms of anaerobic metabolism without oxygen. One, anaerobic respiration, produces lots of ATP, and then we have fermentation. Organic compound as our final product. Organic compound as our final unacceptable. So that means we still have carbon-carbon bonds left over, which means we get less energy out of that glucose. So if we're using fermentation, we get way less energy, about 1/12. 1/12 as much energy because we're throwing it away. We're throwing away a carbon-carbon bond with electrons in it. So fermentation is not very efficient. And we can see how we might have bring it down. You know, they reduce organic compounds. Now, in order to do this little line right here, that is this process of breaking, process of having oxidation reduction reactions occurring with organic compounds or final electron acceptors, requires a different set of enzymes. So that means the organism's genomic information and its own personal evolution has to derive a set of enzymes that will allow an organic compound to be the end of the game. Granted, it's produced less ATP than all glucose, but there's been many, many, many branches of the evolutionary tree that allow this to occur. So that means there are many, many different kinds of enzymes and therefore many different kinds of end products. And we can use these reduced organic compounds, the fermentation end products, to identify the genomic information that produces it. So the clinical value is that we can use fermentation end products for microbial identification. By looking at its metabolic garbage, we can identify who made it. So let's see, if you looked outside of Dr. Krieger's house, you would find a whole bunch of German beer bottles, imported German beer bottles. And if you went outside of Dean Matheson's office, you might find some fancy French wines or something. Okay. And if you went outside the president's office house, you might find in his garbage maybe fancy French champagne. So by looking at the garbage, you can see whose it was. Okay. So if you look outside student houses, you find cheaper beer bottles, beer cans. Not for long though, because the cleaners come by in the streets and pick them up usually around 7 o'clock in the morning. You know that there's people on bicycles with bags and they pick up all of them. But they leave the little blue cups around. So anyway, we have a way of identifying microorganisms by their end products of fermentation. Notice that the end products of respiration doesn't do as much. Water is water is water. Okay? So that doesn't really help as much. But more complex organic compounds can be unique fingerprints, and we use that for identification. For example, spiral E. coli, right? Escherichia coli is a mixed acid fermenter. So we classify it that way. And we look at the end products of this fermentation. Again, glucose to pyruvate, everybody does that, no big deal. But what do you do with pyruvate? Well, they end up with lactic acid, acetic acid, maybe some ethanol, maybe acetate, carbon dioxide, hydrogen. So a variety of things that we can see. And we have this, these are end products of the fermentation process. And they'll be different with different organisms. Again, you need not memorize this. This is one end to gut stuff. But if you were an enterobacter organism, we have different kinds of enzymes. And we identify, we have lab tests that are just designed to do this. So in your general biology, the general microplastic, you add into the lab and identify the organism. This was the basis of the identification process. It wasn't the only, it wasn't just one test, but a series of tests, you may recall. So the end result of that little chart that you would make is that you know what it is. Because Enterobacter and E. coli and Salmonella and Shigella are all gram-negative rods, individual cells, they all look alike on the microscope. So how do we separate them? Sometimes it's just one enzyme. The difference between Salmonella and Shigella have to do with formic acid here. You break it down or not. So we have these very subtle differences, but the enzymes are coming from genomic information. So we're indirectly reading the genetic information of the organism that we infect. Finally, we have demonstrated the ingenuity of the organism. We have something called the Stickland reaction. This is sort of an unusual one. We call it amino acid fermentation. Amino acid fermentation, not a carbohydrate reaction. Well, we have a series of oxidation reduction reactions between pairs of amino acids. Here we see alanine and glycine being together as a pair. That allows us to have a flow of electrons, and all we need is a flow of electrons, and we have a flow of electrons, and we can generate ATP. So the Stickland reaction allows organisms to get ATP from sources other than carbohydrates. And we're basically the carbon-carbon bond that is found in the amino acids. Now, for treatment, we use our understanding of the metabolism of the organism to affect treatment, not only for examination purposes, but also for the organism, but also treatments. Treatments, common treatments such as use of hydrogen peroxide and hyperbaric oxygen chambers. Now, organisms that are aerobic respiring organisms, such as yourself, you will produce as a byproduct of that process some unwanted things. You're going to produce hydrogen peroxide, for example, and you're going to produce something called superoxide, that's O2 minus. So hydrogen peroxide and O2 minus are two end products of the, side products of the process of utilizing oxygen as a final electron acceptor. But since you're designed to use oxygen as your final electron acceptor, you have the enzyme to take care of the inactive things. Now there's a catalase that breaks down, as you can see, breaks down hydrogen peroxide, and a peroxidase that breaks it down. Now of these two enzymes, which one do you think the organism would prefer to use, catalase or peroxidase, and why?
Catalase.
Catalase, because we're reducing the equipment. So this one is an expensive one. Remember that the reducing equipment is expensive to make. Unless you're giving it, of course, that's different. So if you have to make it yourself, it's an expensive process. So we have catalases and peroxidases that are used to break down hydrogen peroxide. And you have these, of course, in yourself. We also have bacteria that will have this use of oxygen. And we'll have superoxide dismutase. Superoxide unstable radical, O2 minus, O2 is an extra electron, and that's going to be broken down to oxygen, broken down to oxygen and hydrogen peroxide. And so we have to then go back to hydrogen peroxide and use the catalyst of the peroxidase. So we can link these together because of this connection here by the end product of the superoxide dismutase being hydrogen peroxide. So we can link them together, we get the superoxide dismutase catalyzing combination, and we end up with water and oxygen. You recall the catalase test of the strength positive identification. You put a drop of hydrogen peroxide and you see it pop up. Or if you rinse your mouth out with some sort of mouthwash, which would be a brightener or something, and it will have a little hydrogen peroxide in it and it'll be bubbling. Well, with a bubbling, you're there and the oxygen generated. So we have this process of handling of these enzymes. What happens if we give oxygen to a strict anaerobe? Like the organisms causing these anaerobic infections in diabetic patients. For example, a classic one is Clostridium perfringens. Clostridium perfringens is a gram-positive rod. Okay. Produces a spore. And causes, among other things, gas gangrene. And gas gangrene is one of the veins, one of the problems associated with these anaerobic infections in diabetic patients. So we have a patient that has poor blood supply. Maybe it's not a diabetic patient at all. Maybe it's you were up backpacking the Porcupine Mountains in the UP and there was a rock slide and your leg got caught. And a big boulder up against your leg and you have been crushed wound and you have distal to the crushed wound, that is away from your heart and the crushed wound, we have and both conditions. Or maybe you were climbing K2 or something like that, and you've got a frostbite of your nose and your ears and your fingers, okay? Maybe through your cheek and so on. The frostbite, actually freezing of the tissues, blocks the flow of oxygen to the tissues, and you see the mouth and ears coming down, and your nose are all black, and your ears are black, and so on. Your fingers are all black. Well, that's dead and dying tissue. So that's areas where anaerobic organisms can grow and do, and then they have to cut off the tips of the nose and the tips of the ears and the fingers and things like that. So anytime we have these anaerobic conditions, we have a problem. So here we have the organism. What if we gave these strict anaerobes? What if we gave them oxygen? We said that oxygen and hydrogen peroxide can be used as treatment. How does that work? Well, in the case of the strict anaerobes, it works. It doesn't work for the anaerobic, the aerobic respiring organisms, or even the facultative organisms. But the strict aerobes, the ones that must be without oxygen, if you give them oxygen, what do they do with it? Well, they use it. Okay? Wow, this is great. Kidney candy stuff. Let's use this stuff. However, they do not have the catalases, the peroxidases, and the superoxide dismutase. So what happens? They have a buildup of hydrogen peroxide and a buildup of superoxide, and that kills them. It's the use of the oxygen and the generation of hydrogen peroxide and superoxide that kills the anaerobic organism. It's not designed to do that. It doesn't have the enzyme to break down the substrate. And that's what really kills them. So it's sort of like, your roommate comes back from the party at about 4 in the morning and sort of staggers in. This past weekend I had a couple of college students knock on my door looking for a fraternity at about 3 in the morning. It was the wrong house. So they were in the wrong place. Right? The same sort of thing happens. The organism is given oxygen and it generates the hydrogen peroxide and the superoxide, and you can't handle it. So these students, maybe they didn't go directly to the fraternity, they had an idea and they went back to their dorm room and they said, it'd really be neat to have a fireplace in our dorm room. So they dragged in a couple of logs and they lit them in the corner of the dorm room. Now they can burn the log just like the organism can use oxygen, but they don't have the little things like chimneys and hearths. And so the smoke builds up in the room and the poor thing is on fire and it wasn't a good idea. Okay? But it wasn't the burning of the log that did it. It's the lack of the structural needs. It's the lack of the chimney and the hearth and so on. It's the same thing. The utilization of oxygen itself didn't do it, but the generation of the hydrogen peroxide and the generation of the superoxide actually did the organism. Knowing that, then we can sort of shortcut it, and we can just pour in to an area that's got poor oxygen amounts. Right? We can pour in a puncture wound, for example, hydrogen peroxide. Okay. So in a puncture wound, we have a gradation of oxygen, and down at the bottom is not much oxygen, so we have anaerobic organisms there. And we know that the anaerobic organisms don't have the catalases and the peroxidase, so we just pour hydrogen peroxide. Your tissue is going to make it bubble, but their tissue, cells will be destroyed. Okay. Or we can take oxygen, it can be under pressure, we have hyperbaric oxygen chambers, and we can force it into the tissue of an anaerobic infection. So when we do rescue from your crushed wound and so on, we can push you in a hyperbaric, or maybe just your leg, in a hyperbaric oxygen chamber, and force oxygen into the tissue, and that will kill off the anaerobic organisms. And that will supplement the use of antimicrobial agents. Because the anaerobes are going to use the oxygen, and that's going to kill them because of the interruption, the side reaction. Now, it doesn't work quite as well with diabetics. You think, well, we'll just put the diabetic's leg and we'll put it into hyperbaric oxygen chamber, and that will be short-term okay. Okay? I mean, that will kill the organism off and supplement the use of antimicrobial agents on the organism. But long-term, we aren't changing anything about the blood supply to that leg. So when we do the amputations and so on that will follow, one of the things we do is we cut back to a stump that is going to have good blood supply. So the surgeon isn't just sitting there walking off with a saw. Well, you see, that looks about good. No, what we do is we try to determine what area can we maybe do some restructuring of the blood vascular system and get good blood supply to that stump. So one, it will heal properly, and two, it will not as quickly develop anaerobic conditions and then be another site for infection. If we don't choose that amputation site well, then we just simply have a series of amputations. When we cut off, you know, below the ankle and then above the ankle and below the knee and then above the knee, we keep doing this, okay? Now we may have to do that for long term anyway because the disease is a progressive disease and what was fine 5 years ago may not be a good spot today. But if we don't choose initially, we'll be doing a lot shorter than that. All about blood supply and oxygenation of tissues and the environment that we're in the world. Control. Two types of control. Allosteric enzyme control, operon level control. Terms you probably have some recognition of, you should remember allosteric, who just applied to microbial bed. And then operon level control, which is introduced to a little bit of difficulty in that. Some of that probably is not allowed. Allosteric simply means other sites. That means a site other than the active site of the enzyme. That other site, the allosteric site, has compounds that will bind to it, creating either increased activity or decreased activity. So we have a positive effector molecule, or another one that we bind would be a negative effector molecule. We should be aware that these are generally positioned specifically at the beginnings of a pathway or at a branch point in the pathway. We don't when we're making the end product we don't need, so we want to shut things down. We shut it down at the appropriate spot, the beginning of the pathway, so we don't have the whole pathway going and not need it. Or at a point in the branch, so don't go this way, go that way, because I'm not the first product of the branch. And it's control of the activity. So allosteric enzymes control activity. Operon level controls synthesis. Do we have the enzyme at all? So operon levels generally are associated with backup systems. We have the main system, which is maybe we have the use of glucose. So the breakdown of glucose would be our main system of getting energy. A backup system might be the breakdown of lactose, the byproduct. So we don't need them both going. We've got one that's working fine, so we use that one first. And then we have the backup system, which is then turned on. So when the glucose is working fine, we turn off the operon level information. We don't make the enzymes, we use lactose. When we need it, because glucose isn't available, we need to have lactose in the life, but we have plenty of that, then the lactose system is now turned on. So allosteric enzyme is always there. We just bring it in its level of activity. It works faster or slower. Operon level control, we're not even making the messenger RNA to make the protein. Everything is still in the DNA, tucked in, sleeping. We don't need it. And so we need it, and we activate it. When we turn it on, we say we induce it. So turning on means activating the messenger to make the protein. If the system was always on, as in the system that's utilizing allosteric control, that's referred to by reference as a constitutive system, meaning always on. So the EMT pathway, the breakdown of glucose to pyruvate, is an always on system and it's controlled by allosteric enzyme. So it's a constitutive system. The backup system, the utilization of byproducts, lactose system, would be an example of one that needs to be induced, turned on when needed. And again, this is controlling operon level, controlling the synthesis of the enzyme. Quickly put here, we have a structure of a gene, or a series of genes, and this gene cluster is known as an operon. The ON has no specific meaning, it just happened to be something in the 60s where we named everything with ON. It just happened. Physics, we have tachyons, and we have interference. Huron and immunology, and we have operons, but all developed at the same time, a lot in the same general area of plants. And so it seems to be that they just moved away. It's just a gimmick name at the time. Anyway, we have operon, which is a gene cluster. A gene cluster includes the structural genes. For example, the genes to utilize lactose. Maybe a transport protein, bring it in at higher amounts than normal, and ways of breaking it down. And then we have a promoter and an operator. The operator is a site where a repressor protein binds. And when the repressor protein is bound on the operator, the genes that follow it in the transcription series are turned off. If the repressor protein is not binding to the operator, then it's induced to come on. The promoter is just where we start the process, the lead chain. So we start reading this gene from the promoter down to the structural genes. If it gets to the operator and there's a block, then it skips over all of those structural genes and goes to the next operon, the way of controlling enzyme synthesis. If we have something that interferes with the presence and function of the repressor protein, or we make it an inactive repressor, then nothing is sitting on the operator, and the promoter binds the transcriptase, and we then copy the rest of the gene. This is how we basically control it. Next time, or at least after our break, we'll talk about the allosteric control example, transcription control. So at this point, let us take a 2-minute